You know, very often, particularly with the issue of human trafficking and human slavery, it is very, very difficult to know, well, what do I do? I mean, I can't go and prosecute the people who are abusing people. What can I actually do in North America? And in part as a response to the issue of human slavery, it is why we jumped into Trade as One. But it's also it also addresses other issues as well. So what I hope to do in this session is really talk about, you know, kind of take a step back and look at some of the kind of larger issues around, you know, some of the brokenness in our world that gives expression to things like human slavery. And then look at just an example of some response to that. And then finally, kind of, so what? What can I do? What can my church do? What you see is a flat line. Everybody was pretty much dirt poor for all of history until there was something that happened that turned that line, and it went up like this. I mean, up and to the right in a huge way. Anyone take a guess what happened for that to occur? Yeah, but before the Industrial Revolution, we discovered coal. We discovered fossil fuels that meant that we didn't have to use our muscles or the muscles of animals to get work done. And by doing that, you then tap into millions of years of energy tapped under the ground that you then employ to do tasks. And then comes the Industrial Revolution, specialization, and up and to the right. And it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to work out that that graph carrying on at that pace cannot be sustained with finite resources. And God help us when that starts to plateau out or even go down, right? And on top of that, then we get used to walking into a supermarket and seeing 40,000 different products on display. Alaskan king crabs, olive oil from Italy, bananas from the Caribbean. We think this is all perfectly normal. This is not normal. Like in all of human history, kings would have blushed to believe that they could live the lifestyle that we have become to accept as normal and that we expect we deserve to live. So what we are experiencing is definitely extraordinary. But that progress has not been evenly distributed. So if you look at the growth per capita over between 1820 and nearly 2000, you see average GDP growth in the US and Canada of 1.7%. You look at Africa at 0.7%. You only need a 1% difference over that amount of time to create a massive inequity in wealth creation. If you take all of the world's population, divide it into a fifth by wealth, the richest fifth have all 82.7% of all the world's income. The poorest fifth have 1.4%. And this champagne glass effect leads to the abuse of people at the bottom because they become, they just become other resources that can be used. And all of the, I loved that video this morning. I can't remember what the video was, Revolution, fabulous, right? But it explores, you know, we know what the top part of the champagne glass looks like, but it explores the two sides of it. And when you juxtapose those two things together, you understand that a God of compassion and justice would not have a world that exists in this way. And so I don't want to go through all of these things. You know, many of you are well aware of them, you know, that a sixth of the world's 6 billion people live on less than $1 a day. That means they can't satisfy the most basic of human needs. And that isn't like giving somebody in Malawi a dollar to survive on. That's as if you take that person from Malawi, you put them in North America, and you give them $1 to exist on every day, and nothing else, no scavenging from the food bins or anything else. They live on the precipice of oblivion, and it doesn't take much to push them over. It could be a war, it could be famine, it could be something that happens in their life. I remember speaking to somebody in India where she was, this girl was determined, she was a high school age, she was determined to become a doctor because her family's life had been lived on that edge of oblivion, and she had been taken in by some Jesuits, and her father, her brother had become ill, And a local doctor had said that that brother needed an MRI scan of all things, and of course he didn't. But the father then, in order to provide the medical care for his son, sold himself into institutional bonded labor and had been there ever since. And the daughter was saying, I'm going to study to become a doctor to pay off my father's debt so I can get him out of bonded labor. I mean, people live like this every day. The top 358 billionaires, you just imagine, there's maybe 1,000 people in that room over there, just say a third of the room, you can imagine how many people that is. I cannot get my head around what half of the world's population looks like. You take the poorest half of the world's population, and they collectively have as many assets and wealth as the richest 358 people in the world. It's just extraordinary, and yet it was still, with all of the giving and of the philanthropy that those people do, 30,000 people die every day, 1 million children are forced into commercial sex work every year. These facts scandalize a God of justice and compassion that we raise our hands to and worship every week. And I think God is asking us in this conference and in other ways. So when we stand there and worship this God of justice and compassion with open hands, what are we doing? What are we going to do with our hands about these things? So that's one side. We've got this, like, it's almost like a world is in simultaneously in two crises. You've got this crisis of extreme poverty that leads to people mortgaging their bodies and their futures and their children. And then on the other side, we have this crisis of meaning where we just don't seem to be able to understand what we were created to be and what we were about. And we live our lives by this script called consumerism, which, by the way, was not something that was just happened. This was designed. This happened after the Second World War. There's an economist, and if you're interested in finding out more, there's a 20-minute video called The Story of Stuff, and I'll show a little clip from it in a bit. Watch that video. It is extraordinarily powerful to explain how this whole mechanism works, from the taking of natural resources through to the disposable things after they've gone through manufacturing and being purchased and then disposed of in our house. But the whole system of consumerism was something that was dreamt up by an economist, and it was after the Second World War in order to stimulate the growth of an economy. So in the absence of anything better to do, we're told that we should go out and buy stuff. So this is a little clip from The Story of Stuff, and I'm going to play two clips just to kind of get us into the mindset of how is it that we have been co-opted in the West to live our lives in such banality, and what is the effect of an unexamined life lived under this notion of consumerism? What effect does it have on people and the planet over which we're told to take charge?
We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at US rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world. Which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that era as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the US, we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop.
She's right. It might be a bit odd to hear from somebody who's founded a company that sells stuff to people, that I agree with all of this, but there is a way to do business differently, a way that looks after the planet, the one planet we have to live on, a way that makes sure that the people who are engaged in that, the production of the products, are treated fairly as we would want to be treated. That is the notion of fairness. It's the golden rule. Treat others as you would want to be treated. And there is a way to do this so that we don't become restless, unhappy consumers, that there can be meaning brought into our lives through use of our financial resources in ways that honor God. I know it's a bit, as I said, a bit strange for the founder of a fair trade company to be talking of these things, but maybe I'm a slow learner, but I was about 40 before I realized the link between business and the story in the Garden of Eden, because before anything went wrong, in whatever you think about the narrative of what happened in the Garden of Eden, before anything goes wrong, man and woman are put there in order to rule the world, to subdue it, and to work the garden. And so, before the fall, work was part of God's intention for how this whole place was meant to function properly, and human beings without a task or a job or responsibility actually are not functioning in the way God designed them. And so the absence of work is very simply a missions issue. Full stop. Okay? I am not an evangelist, but I am a business person. I can smell opportunity, I can read a balance sheet, I can start new businesses, it's what I do. And for me to get to that point in my life and go, oh my goodness, there's a direct correlation between business and the kingdom of God and the restoration of that vision of what creation was meant to be, that was very exciting to me. And so what my wife and I did, we visited many of these producers that are working in the developing world, working with people taken out of human trafficking, out of prostitution, people with HIV/AIDS, and seeing businesses that give these people sustainable jobs to keep them, to give them a livelihood and break those cycles of dependency. And what we saw just blew us away, and we saw the mechanism of fair trade as a very powerful way to engage and give these people access to markets that fuels the vision behind the people who start these businesses. And so we got involved with fair trade back in the UK, and you can tell from my accent I'm not from around here. I live in Santa Cruz, And but I am kind of eventually from the UK through a very long history of being a missionary kid and seeing some pretty weird things in my life. But anyway, when my wife and I, once we had visited these businesses and got involved with fair trade, we were involved with the fair trade movement in the UK for about a couple of years before moving out here. And here's the thing, I mean, the church in the UK is pretty anemic. It's pretty weak. There's about 4% of the population will turn up to church on any given Sunday. 4%. You think the Bay Area is unchurched? You come to my place in the UK, I'll show you what unchurched means. There's roughly 100 million people in the US that go to church on a Sunday. It's kind of, it's mind-boggling to me. So and in the UK, fair trade has been a Christian response to extreme poverty. It's been a for-profit business that has led the way, founded by non-Christian non-profits. And so Tradecraft is a publicly listed, for-profit business. It does about $30 million of business. Half of that business is done through the churches. And for 35 years, the church has been this grassroots movement that has said it is not okay for consumerism to behave in this way and to abuse the planet and abuse people. There is another way of doing business. And they've pioneered a way of doing that and partnering with churches. So I just kind of got to thinking, and we were involved with that, wow, what would happen if the church in North America really got hold of fair trade? I mean, if the UK church can get the general population to 76% public awareness of fair trade and purchasing fair trade and the thousands and thousands of jobs that are created as a result, what could happen if the church here in North America got hold of this? I mean, just mind-boggling. So if you just look at evangelicals, there's something like 60 million evangelicals. If a company in the US did as good a job as Tradecraft in the UK, they would be doing about $450 million of business. That would create roughly 45,000 jobs. And for every woman, and it's overwhelmingly women that you employ in these businesses, for every woman that you employ, you will impact 10 lives. She's going to spend her money on buying food, and you're injecting foreign investment into an economy in that way. She's going to be looking after her children and her family's future and financial future and saving for all those things. So, you know, you could have 500,000 lives affected just through churches engaging in fair trade. And this is not with another single cent being given. Okay, we're not talking about getting people to reach into their wallets and give money away. We're not talking about people spending more money on stuff that they don't need. So Traders One does not sell wooden giraffes and ponchos and rainbow-colored alpaca wool hats. They might be trendy, I don't know, but we just don't sell them. We sell stuff that people need because I don't want to be promoting consumerism in order to dig people out of poverty. That's not the way forward. We need to sell stuff that people are buying every day. And it needs to be of the quality of Nordstrom's and Macy's and Target, and it needs to be stuff that people are going to be spending their money on anyway. Now, if you can do that and at the same time proclaim good news to the poor, freedom to the captive, recovery of sight to the blind — blindness in Jesus' day or in Isaiah's day was a pandemic. Today, that pandemic is HIV for us. So read recovery of sight as HIV. If by just changing some of the ways in which we go about buying things and using our financial resources, we can proclaim good news to all of these people, I just think that is stinking cool. That is so powerful. Because there isn't enough money being given away. You can't ask for enough money to fix some of these problems. And maybe, you know, maybe if I'm really financially diligent, I'm going to give 10% of my gross income away. But what about the other 90%? Like, we're not even, as a church, we're not even talking about that. We're certainly not capturing it. So if the church says, no, our spending is a discipleship issue, and we will spend in solidarity with the poor and the sick and the abused and the trafficked, could you have any idea of how much power there would be in the North American church if it started to do this? It's phenomenal. And that is what Traders One's vision is. So just some stories. Nightlight in Bangkok, founded by Annie Dieselberg and her husband, Jeff. right in a red light district in Bangkok. They walk into the bars, they minister to women there, and they say, there is another way to live your life. You can have a job making jewelry. We make jewelry and we pay people a good salary to do that. And in doing that, they also introduce people to Jesus. Now, these are not women who have been, many of them not been directly trafficked. It's a very specific and dangerous work to be in. And experts like IJM and others are the experts to release people from the clutches of the abusers. But these are more women who have just been duped, lied to, and ensnared. And then once they're ensnared, they just cannot get out of these lives. And this is one of them. In the past, my life felt hopeless. All I could do was go through life, letting it take its course. Since coming to Nightlight, my life has direction. Nightlight is a special gift to me. I receive true love from mothers, friends, and sisters. Now I can see the path before me. I have a warm and caring place to go. I'm thankful to Nightlight for this new day, and I thank God. Now, the tragic thing is they employ 85 women doing this, and they have a waiting list of about 200 women who want jobs, but they can't give those jobs to those women because there's not enough demand right now. So, one of the things that we are passionate about doing is to say, you know, it's not wrong to wear jewelry, and it's actually an expression of our human creativity and all of the things which God has created us to reflect in His glory. So, if we do wear jewelry, why don't we make jewelry that sets people free, that gives people freedom? And what I think is so cool is when we go and do events and we sometimes take cards. These are like almost like prayer cards. If any of you've done the World Vision caregiving kit, you put in prayer cards, and those are some of the most moving things. These are people who've been to events that we've been at, and they've written messages back to the women who've made their products for them. And so this woman's saying, I can make a difference by wearing jewelry that I actually love and promote free living at the same time by buying it and sharing where I got it from. I always wanted to do something, but I didn't know how. And then these ones as well, very moving one, particularly on the right. I've never made a purchase for a better cause. As a victim of child and sexual abuse, I'm grateful to your efforts to proclaim freedom to the captive. The cool thing is that as we engage in a way of behaving that is closer to the way in which I believe God would have us live our lives, it's not just that we're helping some poor, helpless person on the other side of the world. Our lives cannot help but be touched and impacted as well. And the stories of people here who've had this kind of aha moment, like I've been blessed, and through me there can be blessing on the other side of the world as a result of choices that I make, and telling people about where I get these things. So I wanted to also talk about Hagar. This is an organization founded about 15 years ago by a friend of mine called Pierre Tammy. He's Swiss, and he and his family moved to Phnom Penh in Cambodia. Hagar look after single mothers who've been either trafficked or physical violence has been given to them, and they are on the streets of Phnom Penh.
More and more children at a younger and younger age are being used for sex, are being trafficked here in Cambodia. And once the authorities would rescue these children, the question is, okay, where are they going to go? And so I decided to open up a shelter for this, basically bringing the message of comfort of, don't be afraid, we're going to take care of you.
Hi,
soon as we started to see women and young girls go into vocational training, we soon find out that their ability to reintegrate in society was very, very difficult, particularly because of the problem of stigmatization that prevent socially the full integration of these women and young girls. So we came up with the idea, why don't we start our own businesses for the purpose to create jobs for these particular women and girls so that we can see the full circle of from the street, from a brothel, all the way to a meaningful employment. We are specialized on the individual mother and the child who have escaped and flees from war, displacement, violence, and abuse. And we want her, and our focus is her and her alone, to get there where she can have a future and a hope.
I just love how she finishes that. Now I am brave. Because when God meets us, the number one response of human beings when God interacts with them in the Bible is fear. And I actually think our biggest problem with Jesus' message is fear, that it's so radical for us, it's too difficult to give everything up for. And we're afraid of it. And I just love seeing this woman say, I used to be frightened all the time. I lived my life in fear. And now, because God has touched her through Hagar, she's brave. That's the factory. I mean, extraordinary story. Hagar now employs about 600 women, which is phenomenal. And this is the factory that makes the bags. You can see these bags that they make. They are really super cool. I mean, they take recycled material. These are animal feed bags. They take them, they dye them, and they make really, really good bags with them. And I'm on the phone to the CEO there of Hagar probably once a week anyway. And one of the most challenging things right now is he's had to lay off roughly 35% of his women just because he doesn't have the cash to run his business because of the economy's being tanked. And so we're just kind of trying to think through, are there other things that you can make with the skills of the women there so we don't have to lay these women off? And but to see this, to see this factory was, this is a 600,000 square foot factory given to them by Nestle's when they pulled out of Phnom Penh. It's extraordinary. And God has done amazing things there through them. So I'm going to stop talking now. I need to go that way. And I'm happy to answer questions. Grab me after the conference if you like. I'm going to hand over to Kevin because one of the things we want to answer is, so what? What about me? What can I do? And so we've got some ideas for you.
Thank you, Nathan. Yeah, so like Nathan said, I'm Kevin, and I work with Nathan, and I'm sorry that listening to my voice is not as pleasant as listening to Nathan's. You're just going to have to persevere. As I'm kind of putting myself in your shoes, sitting here, being in this conference, listening to what Nathan's saying about fair trade, I know the number one thing that I'd be thinking and asking is like, great, I get it, I understand. Like, I see the problem, I see that fair trade is a solution. What do I do? I know that's probably the question that's on a lot of your guys' mind right now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just kind of back up a little bit, and I'm going to talk about the primary way that we work, and that's partnering with churches, and just kind of explain a little bit of the nuts and bolts of how that works. We wholeheartedly, passionately believe that the church is the answer. Not only do we have God telling us over and over again what his mission for the church is in Scripture, I think we have an amazing model of, like Nathan talked about, in the UK, of what the church did. I mean, it's not necessarily, we don't have to recreate the wheel. I mean, lucky for us, they've shown us how to do it. And the consequences of what they did, I mean, are just vast and unbelievable. So that's why we partner with churches. So the way we do that is kind of all year long, we'll be at different churches, it seems like, almost every weekend. Just meeting people. So I'll just tell you like what we did at Willow Creek these last we were there 3 weekends in a row. The last one was the weekend before last. So they did this. They do this thing called Celebration of Hope, and it's this amazing thing that they lead 15,000. I mean, really, 15,000 rich white people in South Barrington, Illinois. That they would describe their church the exact same way. But what they're doing is radical and extraordinary and sacrificial. So the idea was, it's so hard for us to have any kind of solidarity with the poor because our lives are so different from the poor. And until we can put ourselves in their shoes, even just a little bit, how in the world can I have empathy? Or like in that Steve Stenstrom in that greeting at the beginning said, like, you haven't prayed for somebody until you've thought about how I can be the solution to that, to their prayer. So anyway, so what they did is they took their whole 15,000 member church, and for a couple of weeks, all they ate was rice and beans. They said, we're going to equal the caloric intake of half of the world for a couple of weeks, and we are going to be hungry and cranky, and we're going to come home from work and be like, are you freaking kidding me? Another day of rice and beans? But we're going to do it. And so they did all that. All the money they saved, plus a ton more, they gave away. And they ended up raising like $1.5 million for clean water projects. I mean, it's just one church that's going on a journey. And so they brought us on as a part of that. So that basically the three principles that they were getting across was live simply, which was the way they were going through that was obviously only eating rice and beans for a couple of weeks. Give generously, which at the end of that, they all gave away, like I said, a ton of money. And the third piece was buy ethically. And so the way they saw it, and it's something we've kind of adopted as well, those three principles, is that is what it looks like when your faith informs your wallet. Those are the three expressions. I'm going to buy less, I'm going to give more, and the things that I do buy, I'm going to make sure they're redemptive and they're restorative. So we showed up there, Nathan got interviewed, you know, we did like some education, and then we just allow people, we set up a huge market and just allow people to purchase fair trade goods. And then on the tail end, what we do at a lot of churches is we'll do something like that, and then people invariably were coming up to us beginning of last year saying, great, this is awesome, I love your olive oil, especially the olive oil. Everybody digs the olive oil. They're like, it's amazing, it's a really cool story, it's from Palestine, some of the oldest olive trees in the world. And they're like, but in a month, it's going to be gone. So, you know, what do I do? So we set up, you'd think we would have thought of this, but it actually took like 15 people asking us the same question before we caught on. So we set up these things called trading posts, where we've got coffee, chocolate, tea, olive oil, lotions, body care, all the stuff that you buy and you go through, consumables. And churches now have this in their bookstore, or sometimes it's just a committed woman, it's always a woman, who sets up a table in the back every weekend or once a month or whatever, and then she just says, here, you can buy your fair trade stuff here. Instead of buying it here, you can buy it here. And then the church becomes the center for fair trade purchasing in the community. So it's a really cool model. I mean, I kind of manage that program, so a lot of times I'm talking to the people that run them, and I was talking to this guy, John, in Texas, so I guess sometimes it's a man. And he was just saying, yeah, I had this conversation with this person the other day, and I watched him walk in, two weeks in a row, I watched him walk in, make a purchase, and leave. And so after I saw them do this repeatedly, I grabbed him, and I was like, you know, ma'am, what's up? Like, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself. She's like, oh, no, I don't really know very much about the church, but I mean, all I really know is this is a place where I can buy stuff that makes the world better. And he was like, how cool is that? That's the only thing they really know about the church. Like, what a great evangelism tool, what a great apologetic, that love in action. So anyway, there's a bunch of different ways we partner with churches. There's actually some people here in the room whose churches we've partnered with in the past. It's really cool. But I'm going to jump over now to what each of us can do individually. And so first of all, the number one thing that any of us can do, which is not on the slide, it's changing your spending habits. I mean, it has to start personally. I mean, we all, Nathan says every time you open your wallet, you're voting. And so you vote. Actually, it's really funny. Usually the way he does it is he'll be on stage at a church and he's like, hey, so how often do you guys get to vote here in America? And he gets to like play the dumb British guy. Oh, I don't really know. And the funny part is no one knows. Everyone's like, oh, every 4 years.